The Creative Trust is a podcast about the creative process. Amanda Henderson founded Gloss Creative in 2001 and has been making fabulous happen ever since. Gloss Creative and its alumni have mastered the art of creative renewal. Listen as Amanda sits down to explore some of the world's best creative minds. These are their insights, and this is their legacy. Welcome to the Creative Trust.
People think it's hysterical. I don't even have a calendar. I don't run a calendar. I don't take notes. I'm just full out there in the world, remembering as I go.
So I guess this is the beginning of the podcast then.
Yeah, I guess
Great. Okay, so we are. I'm sitting here with Andy Kelly from Ogle Projects, and I was just trying to work out, apart from obviously seeing each other on Gertrude Street all the time, we met in 2023 at a panel talk that we were both in for Claire Beale on exhibiting your designs for, I think it was Design Week or something.
Yeah, from my memory, the panel was, organised by the DIA, the Design Institute
of
Australia.
That's it, yes.
And I don't know how I ended up on it, but it was you, me, Marsha Golmick, who I love.
Of course.
And then two architects, and the architects obviously were quite esoteric in their answers. And there's Marsha, you and I being like, you've got to sell the stuff. Who cares how it's displayed? We're about selling the gear.
And that was my first impression. I was like, this guy has a different background. And then we, 5 minutes later, I'm like, have you worked in VM? And you're like, yeah, I've worked in VM. And that made complete sense. You're completely comfortable with the retail aspect of things.
You have to
Hello,
be.
Commerce and creativity. Boom.
It's so funny when you – every decision that I make in respects to the curation of the gallery is done from a visual merchandising and retail point of view. I do not – even my work – because I also now work at the Art Foundation – kind of delivering the Melbourne Art Fair, I still approach everything from a retail point of view. And it was...
Love that.
Those titans that trained me, like Paul Zara at David Jones, like that were all about experience, customer experience, spatial experience. Like it might not be the most... Definitely within the world of curatorial expertise, it is looked down upon. Why, I don't know. But it is... I approach... everything from that point of view, everything in my
Absolutely.
Life. I don't
I
let
love
it go.
That.
Yeah.
Well, it's obvious. So I want to, let's just rewind that clock. Okay. Way back, young Andy. So the question we ask everyone is, how did you get creative? I want to know about what was young Andy doing?
Well, I'm an only child and both my parents are quite older. So I wouldn't say I was an accident, but I probably wasn't kind of on the cards. I think being an only child, a lot of my friends are only children. In my opinion, we are the best kind of people. But we do have to spend a lot of time alone or with adults. So childhood, I guess, is compromised. Like you don't play like with another kid
every
constantly.
Moment,
yeah, you have to kind of invent your own narrative. So I would spend hours spinning a mop around. I used to have this pink satin sheet I would tie into all sorts of different gowns and walk around the backyard full of cobbler's pegs in. You kind of had to build this world out. And I think that's where creatively I probably laid roots. And then I was, a very privileged person. I got to go to a very wonderful school that had arts programs, had contemporary, they would take you to the gallery, they would take you to the ballet. So I was...
And isn't that a great thing?
Yeah, because my parents weren't taking me. That was made clear
that
Yeah, we're farmers. We're farming people. We're out...
So were you in the country?
Really in the country. Okay, like middle of nowhere, pushing over cows.
Great. That's...
Vast.
That's why.
Yeah, on Amazing. A horse. Like I could ride a horse before God. I could walk. So for me... My imagination, look, I've never been addicted to drugs, but I am addicted to glamour. And I've always been addicted to glamour. Even when I was a child, I always was drawn to the sparkly, expensive, luxurious thing. And it didn't exist out there. So I had to invent it in my mind.
But how did you see it somewhere on telly or did you?
I don't know. I guess my aunt was pretty glam. I don't know. It must have been television. It must have been movies and books. Again, when you're an only child too, I think there's a misconception that you're like very policed and doted on by your parents. But what I have found through my experience and my friend's experience is you're actually left to your own devices quite a lot because your parents just trust that you're doing a normal thing. So I was probably reading books that I shouldn't have been reading, watching television shows that I shouldn't have been watching. So I kind of built up, I definitely still do live in somewhat of a fantasy land. And my imagination was my ability to travel. Like as a kid, I wanted to have that kind of life. So I had kind of padded it out for myself. And then as I've become an adult, I've just made it a reality. Like, you know, I would watch TV shows like Sex in the City way too young an age. And I'd be like, oh, I'm going to be a Carrie. Yeah. I'm going to have fabulous shoes and I'm going to go to art galleries and I'm going to, you know, write beautiful things.
Not a bad training, as it turns out.
Absolutely not. No. Not a bad training. So I think too, also being queer, you kind of, and I'm gay. I'm gay. I love gay stuff. So I think too, that also probably helped fracture me away from reality. Because you're in, when you're young and you're gay and you're a bit weird, you're in a survival mode. So you can you can turn inward and you just create your own kind of Fabergé egg to live in. And then I think eventually people like me, we leave and we find our community and we find our family and we start, one, to pull apart the pieces that aren't real that we have done just for survival. But then the bits we love, we kind of start putting into practice and implementing, and we build
the world.
These worlds that we want to occupy. Mm. Yeah, I often say my reality is not the reality, but it's my reality.
Well, that's what's so beautiful.
Yeah,
that's the holy grail, isn't it?
Totally. And yeah. I think I found that kind of joy when I left school and I was studying and I was moving to a city. I found that in retail and in department stores and in, you know, the glamour of a Ralph Lauren setup and in the David Jones windows. Like I can see how I washed up on those shores pretty quickly because it was fantasy and, you know, you could
be whatever the day's job was.
Totally. And I couldn't afford to buy, you know, Saint Laurent bag then, but I could use it
on the mannequin. You could make totally. It look
totally. It was essentially mine. So it became that definitely. I think in that's why I've held it so close. And when people are like ugh, at it, I'm like no. You don't understand. Yeah. You don't understand what it's like to do a window for Dior. Like it's so like frivolously over the top, and you're stressed about nothing that matters. Like, oh no, the organza's not hanging right. Like, you know, you're crying in a back room because the steamer put a watermark on the carpet.
And we're all going to lose our jobs.
Yeah. And I think I loved that silly tension.
Yes. I love it. I mean, there was so much I loved about, having a creative grounding in retail.
Yeah.
Because there were so many different brands you could work with.
Totally.
Stylistically, you had to change it up. You were a chameleon.
Absolutely.
And I think that stylistic changeover means that you can observe different styles and you don't have to be one of them. You understand very early on as a VMer.
Yeah.
You can jump across.
Totally.
And that's clearly
it's
what you've done. You'll get to what you've achieved. Yeah, totally. But in the first instance, that's when you try this, try that, try this. And it's an unbeatable playground.
Absolutely. And you learn about different lifestyles, holistic aesthetics, and what it means to build I was very lucky that my career, I wasn't a VM at Best and Less. I was I had managed to lie my way into being with, I was working with the luxurious of luxury. And there is no reason I should have been there doing that job.
Life qualifies you.
Yeah, life qualifies you. Yeah. I think they were just like, oh, hire the sassy gay one. He'll get it. But, you know, learning about the heritage of those things and these your fashion houses and how they work and creative directors and that kind of thing gave me an appreciation for lots of different, you know, aesthetics and how it works. And, you know, you might not like Emilio Pucci, but you have to respect what is built there and, you know, what it stands for and how it operates and the codes of a house. And I think when you can take that and then apply it to where I am now in collectible design, contemporary art, interiors, all of those things has meant that I can walk into spaces, and although it might not be for me, I can understand how we do it so that it is like an all-encompassing experience. I don't have a set agenda. Like, I'm not worried about what I like, because what I like is what I like, and that's what is in my home. But I'm able to appreciate a lot of different things, and that comes from that retail grounding.
And I guess then it's, you can express it. If you can understand it, you've had the background, you can express it.
Like, there's nothing wrong with making money, let me tell you about it. There's nothing wrong. I feel like sometimes within this space we never want to talk about the sordid topic of coin, but making money's great.
Yeah.
And I've got to make these people think that they cannot live their life without this lamp. They, like, if it comes down to lamp or oxygen, I need them to pick lamp.
Yeah, yeah.
And you do that.
Light but nowhere.
Yeah, light but nowhere.
Mood but nowhere.
And to be fair, I agree. but I, you know, like that, I need that, like, level of disbelief and being able to suspend people's understanding is...
of the everyday.
Of the everyday, yeah. and then make it commercially viable.
I love that.
Because that's, I think, where a lot of the people fall off, is they don't make it commercially viable.
So I just want to understand, with your early career, how do you think that your education shaped where you are? Like, back at your school days, you know, with your teachers and that sort of thing, you know, you're very articulate, you're very clever with your words.
Yeah.
Were you sharp at school?
Oh, I was terrible. I was so bad. I was so bad. I was bad, and I was completely untouchable, because what I did, and I still do this to this day, I see myself, I'm quite manipulative. I'm actually a very manipulative person, which I take as a negative trait, but it can be used positively.
In PR. Hello.
Yeah, it is. And
the number one quality required.
Neil Hughes said to me once, we were laughing about who the best PR is, and he turned to me very quietly, said, the best PR is you. Because I it is true. But I made my first port of call was to become friends with all the teachers. So as an only child, I was very good at interacting with adults. So I've gone in there and I've made really close personal relationships built on, like, humor. And again, I was reading things and digesting media and stuff that was way above where what I should have been, so I could connect with these older people on a more, like, personable level, which then meant that when I was atrocious to other students, it was funny and sharp, and, like, you couldn't really pull me up on it, but we knew that it was bad. It was a bit wrong, but it was, you know, it's hard to punish someone when you're laughing at the joke too. So,
yeah, it's like the parent seeing something funny and trying to cover it up. Like, I shouldn't be laughing, but oh my God, that's hilarious.
What can we do? I think too, like, I had a very good education. I'm very grateful. Education is so important to anyone. If you are lucky enough to go to a good school or have teachers that support you, great. You like, what are we, like, the 1% of the world who gets that? I think, though, what school taught me was to network. I went to school with a lot of, like, high profile, high net worth children, like kids of people, affluent people. And my parents weren't like that. I was there because of distance and I had to go to a school. And I think a lot of kids from the country find that. They find themselves in private schools and boarding schools due to proximity, not due to affluence.
Yeah, or social.
Connections. Social connections.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, this is networking. All of these parents, like, my parents didn't know very many people there, but all of these parents know each other and all of them work together and all of them go on holidays in Aspen. That's interesting. It's interesting. So I think early on picked up the importance of looking at institutional situations like school or uni or, I don't know, workplaces. And I was like, oh, okay. It taught me how to network and it taught me how to foster relationships and maintain relationships. And I learned that early
on. Hello, ticket to building a business.
Number one. And I have been trained in the world of mentors. I've always had amazing mentors. I've always been able to sniff them out. I'm like a bloodhound for a mentor. And I think I learned that there. I learned that through the relationships with the teachers that I formed close bonds with. And that's how I have progressed in my career over the years, was finding people who know more than me and extracting the information from them. I don't necessarily want to learn it from a book. I don't think I'm that kind of girl, but I will find somebody who does it better than me or has done it a lot longer than me, and I want to learn from them.
I love that. And yeah, I always say that the way to level up is to find that mentor.
Absolutely.
Someone who, as they grow, brings you with them. Totally. Brings you with them.
Absolutely. And the plot twist is when you get a mentor, like my number one mentor now, who's probably been the greatest mentor of my life, is Sophie Gannon, who runs a very slick gallery, Sophie Gannon Gallery.
And she's been doing it for very long time.
Since Jesus was in short pants. Like, I'm pretty sure, yeah, she put the first piece of art in, I don't know, like the Sistine Chapel. Like, I'm pretty sure she worked with Michelangelo on the roof. But they, like, what I have learned now that I'm older and I have a little bit more perspective, when I was younger, I always thought they were helping me and I'm not giving them anything. But when you have a really great symbiotic relationship with a mentor, I'm connected to the now. So while I'm getting this amazing industry experience from these mentors, wisdom. I'm also adding a layer of like cool young chaos. And you do need each other. Like, it is a symbiotic relationship. Like, if Sophie is the shark, I'm the little fish that swims underneath that cleans the gunk out of her gills. You need both.
I'm sure she'll be thrilled to hear that.
Shit, she got clean gills. Let me tell you. But I think that's the thing when you find those mentors and you build that community, whatever I get from them, I also have to offer up as much like knowledge of the now, because you know, those, when you become super successful, and I now have young people that I mentor that also keep me young. So it's like, it becomes a totem pole.
The expert and the learner is such a time honored way of learning.
Totally.
I just love that. I remember I worked with a fabulous guy called Maddie Cannon, and we were working at Country Road at the time. And I don't know, we were having a morning or something, and he goes, "Oh my God, you have drank from the fountain of youth."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh my God, you have drunk from the fountain of wisdom."
Yeah.
And it's true.
You need both. Yeah. I think it's the only way that I really know how to operate. And I guess within the creative sphere, we're really bad at progression planning. Like the creative business, there's never a progression plan. There's never anyone waiting in the wings to take over when I die or retire.
No, because it's so individual.
And people are paying for you. They're not paying, they're paying for me to do it. They're not paying for my assistant to do it. So I think too, the mentorship cross-business model, it helps fill that void too. So, you know, I think this kid that I'm helping, or maybe one day when I've had a gut full of this and I turn this gallery into a 7-Eleven, start making some real money, I'll just send
smokes.
I'll just send all my clients to them. Like, it's not, I don't think we have these models where, you know, I will retire and I'll pass this on to someone else. I think that happens very rarely, actually.
I feel like, you know, people collect their skills along the way and then apply it to their bloom point, their thing. And that's the way it lives on.
Totally.
It's molded and changed. But,
yeah. You
know, I always say, like, I could look at, you know, 5 decades of VMers that I could name that, you know, I was trained by someone, then I trained them, then they trained them. I could name that 5 decades of people.
Yeah.
They're all doing different things.
Yeah.
But it is woven down the line.
It's kind crazy.
You know, it's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I love that you love mentors. Do you also have a coach? Or is your mentor vibes the coaching thing?
If I was to describe how I approach my relationships with my older betters, is I probably play the role of like a cheeky younger brother. Like, I refer to Sophie as Auntie Sophie. Sophie and I are very close. It's very loose. We're like family. But then I've received some amazing advice in my life from Anna Schwartz at Anna Schwartz Gallery. Those nuggets she has given me have been ones that I hold very close to me. She probably doesn't even remember saying the things to me, but her and Grace have also been very supportive and incredible. But that's a lot more formal, and that's probably a little bit more like a different relationship. Yeah. But usually I operate in a very casual, like, if you need anything, call me. And if I need anything, trust, I'm calling you. Coaching, I don't know if I would respond well in that environment, like business coach, training. I think I still want to slam my fingers in the car door and then call you up and be like, Eep, how do I deal with this?
Yeah, okay.
Like I'm still...
You're kinetic.
Yeah, like I still have to, yeah, I still have to burn the bridge. You might just help me like put the fire out. And that is...
let's write our learnings for next time.
let's not let this happen again. And I think that I would love to be logical enough that a coach would work for me. I could probably have used some like serious coaching when we were doing things like figuring out things like GST and how to pay people like that.
All of that would have been good. How did you end up being a visual merchandiser?
I got a job as a VM looking after, I think I was just working in a shop. Jeez, I'm going back in my memory palace here. Yes, I was working in a shop that had a concession in a Maya. And I would I had style. Like I'd sass my concessioner.
Of course.
And then they were looking for a VM and the VM manager was just like, why don't you come and work here? So I did that and I did really well. And I got trained in their standards. This was a regional Maya's as well. So let me tell you. I'm grabbing glamour from the jaws of absolute mediocrity. Then I moved to Sydney. I moved to Sydney and I needed a job. And there was a opening for window designer at DJ's in the city in Elizabeth Street, Market in Elizabeth Street. And by chance, I knew the creative director who was in the head office at the time, Kate Charles. And I don't know what load of bullshit I had to write on my CV to get that job, but I got it.
Great.
And I was there for 5 years. Well, I was doing other things, like I was going to school, I was going to uni, I was trying things out, but I was still there doing that. And it was like across the road from Hermes, and you would see what they were doing their windows. And I think that point, DJs were still privately owned, and so it was before South African Woolworths bought it. And there was a bit of budget, but not a lot. It was kind of 2010. We've come out of the GFC. Times are tough. We're starting to be in that lexicon of, and because it was on such a shoestring, they would give me a lot of leeway in the windows. Like I got a lot of like,
what a great opportunity. Freedom.
And I don't think you get that now because I think we've gone back to more of a brand pays a lot of money, delivers it. We had a lot of freedom. Like I'm putting taxiderm peacocks with fine jewelry around their necks in windows. I'm doing stupid things with my colleague May. And then I bounced around doing that. And then from DJs, I met a few people who had other businesses, Glue Store, JD Sport, Topshop. And I just started like consulting out to them, doing bits and pieces independently. And then I went and did that for a few years. And that kind of changed. It was less like VM in a traditional sense that I was doing, and it was more like arranging furniture in stores, fit outs, builds, kind of boring stuff like that. But it was good training for kind of my reinvention at 30, which is kind of where I am now.
So did that lead to you coming to Melbourne?
During this period, I've kind of glazed over this other element of my life. When I was in Sydney, I was a bit of a man about, and this is how I got down to Melbourne. So when I was in Sydney, I was also a bit of a man about town. So my best friend in the whole world, Christian Wilkins, and I were, I mean, I don't want to use the word socialite because it's an ugly word, but we would end up in the Daily Mail a lot. We were at lots of parties. We were at lots of events. This was kind of pre-influencer era, but we were like this, we were in the start of that wave.
You were the curve.
Yeah, we were the curve. So we're out and about and we were always ambassadors for spring racing. One year we were guests of Lexus or might have been back when Lavazza was doing it or Mum. Anyway. And we were down and we're doing a big year. Usually we just do Derby Day, but we thought let's do the whole spring racing calendar. And it used to be like the best part of our year was going down to spring racing. We'd curate the outfits. Like it was so, we'd hang out with Melissa Hoyer and you'd think we were in Paris the way we'd carry on about it. Anyway, so we came down. I had recently been dumped by my ex-boyfriend, whose name is also Mitchell. My current boyfriend's name is Mitchell too. Only Mitchell's. It just keeps it streamlined. We had a huge Derby Day, like so big. Like Christian was throwing up into a mop bucket in the Mum Marquee. Like we had really, we'd given it a huge nudge. So then on Sunday, we were like, well, let's go out. We need to recover. So in Brisbane, there's like a big Sunday session at the Beresford where all the gays converge to listen to Kylie Minogue. So we had typed in to Google like where the Melbourne equivalent was, and it was a bar called the Emerson, and we went out. We went out, and I'm single. So Christian's like, who's cute? And I was like, ugh, no, everyone in Melbourne's ugly, but that one's cute. And it was a young gentleman whose name is also Mitchell, who is my now partner of 8 years. Oh. So I met Mitchell out then, and we dated for 6 months long distance. I was still in Sydney consulting, doing stuff, VM stuff, partying, like you, Christian and I had a podcast, doing like red carpety things. And then I would make Mitchell fly up to Sydney every weekend because I'm not coming down to Melbourne. I used to refer to Melbourne as provincial. I'd be like, it's so provincial down there.
It kind of is. And we love it.
Yeah, as someone who lives down here and loves Melbourne to death, now I'm like, not untrue, but not in the way I meant it.
In a European way.
In a European way, not in a horse and wagon way. And then eventually got to the point. Now, Mitchell is a very successful architect. He's been an architect down here for 105 years. He was like, I'll move up to Sydney. And I was like, what? What for? To sit in Christian's pool? No, you can't leave your career. I'll move down to Melbourne. I was like, I was ready for a change. Sydney had become a bit commercial at that point. When I had moved to Sydney, it was kind of like the epicenter of weirdos, but they'd kind of all dispersed down to Melbourne anyway. And that is how I washed up on the shores of Melbourne.
And we're so glad that happened.
I love it.
I'm here for it. I want to hear everything.
So Mitchell and I buy this adorable little warehouse in Collingwood. We move in. This is where we're going to live forever. We're going to die in this little warehouse. COVID happens. We're trapped in there. Love COVID. Love you. I got so fat. I got fat. I got skinny. I got fat. I got skinny. It was amazing. During COVID, Mitchell and I, to stave off boredom and stop each other from killing each other. We start designing furniture made of slab aluminium, which turns into
the curve.
Yeah, which turns into Brood Studio. But we start just designing. I would cut out these marquettes out of cardboard, then Mitchell would put them into the computer, and then we would send them off to a laser cutter. They would come and we would like sand them and assemble them in our dining room. And the reason we designed them like that is because we didn't have access to any tools. We had a set of old files that Mitchell had inherited from his dead grandfather, and that was it. So that was all we had. So we kind of reverse engineered making this furniture. Side quest, I'll be really quick here. When you're a VM at Maya, there is a table called the Barsoma table, which you use for setups, and it's three pieces of MDF. The legs slot together and then a top goes on top. And you do it for like fragrance.
Yes.
The method of Brood is inspired by that table that I used to use when I was a VM. Anyway.
I love that. So because silly. VM things are the simplest and the most efficient.
Idiot proof. Yeah. So anyway, we maybe make like three chairs.
You said idiot proof and I said efficiency. Simplicity.
Yeah. Take from it what you want, listeners. This is how stupid Mitchell and I are. Fuck, we are so stupid. So we designed maybe three chairs. Three of the ugliest chairs you've ever fucking seen, too. Like, they are a sin. If they came out now, we'd be ruined. My logic in my brain, in my tiny pea brain, because I know nothing about nothing. I don't know nothing about birth and no babies. I'm like, oh, well, we need a showroom. We've got to show people these pieces of furniture. Mitchell's a very sensible, risk-adverse, normal human being. He's gone, okay. So we just randomly get on realestate.com. We love Gertrude Street. Mitchell's always loved Gertrude Street. His maternal grandmother's name was Gertrude. And we're just like, let's just buy a commercial building on Gertrude Street. We have no idea what we're doing. We've never bought commercial property. We have a tiny amount of money in savings, like a pittance. We have no idea what we're doing. We full think we're going to have this like showroom of Brood. We end up finding somewhere on Gertrude Street, try to buy it, can't buy it. I've got it in my blood now, though. I must do this. Like, the ADHD is focused in.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. It can't not happen. This place comes up.
Determination, I call that.
Determination, or just honestly blind. We have no business plan. And then we take it to Mitchell's dad, who's an accountant, my father-in-law. Again, very sensible, very risk-averse man, very logical. And this is my manipulative nature. Somehow I convince these good, kind, hardworking people that this is a good idea. I convince them, let's spend $3 million on a building on Gertrude Street. Let's do it. Anyway, we miss out on this one. Mitchell and I are devastated, won't get out of bed for days. Then there's one more available on Gertrude Street because things don't come up for sale on that street very often. This place on the corner, 122, Joe, my father-in-law, was like, go and have a look at it. And it was a hovel, like a hovel that cannot be described through words. Like the worst, I walked out, we went and viewed it. I walked out and I had a woman's handbag at the time. I'm clutching this Saint Laurent handbag by the top handle, like at the bottom of the stairs, just shaking my head at Mitchell, being like, no. Like it reeked of piss. It was the worst. Like you wouldn't burn it down. You'd just blow it really hard and it would fall.
Did that play into a good thing? You know?
Well, I was like, we're not going to do it. I don't want to. I was like, this is too much work, Mitchell. We can't do it. Mitchell was like, yeah, same, yuck. But Joe was like, no. This is the one. So then for somehow the tables turned there and then Joe was like, no, this is the one. And then he convinced me that it was the one.
Oh, okay.
And then that's how it ended up there. That was the one. And it was easy enough to get because nobody else wanted to buy the dump.
Well, but that's, you know, if you can have a vision for it.
If you can have a vision. And then it started. Like it started to seep into my brain pretty quickly. It was also much bigger than the other one we were trying to buy. And then I was like.
Because you were able to live there too.
Yeah. So we turned
that's up. That's efficiency.
Yeah. We turned upstairs into our home. Anyway, so it was like it didn't take us long to get our head around it, but that is kind of the origin story of how we ended up with this space. Was it was going to be a showroom for our practice, and then, I don't know, there was brief talks about Mitchell having some kind of architecture office firm in the back.
The firm.
Yeah, the firm, as if we were like Paul and Hamish from Heckers. Like in my head it's like 40 really beautiful women in pencil skirts like typing on typewriters.
Bring on the typing pool.
Yeah, that's it. I'll just talk to Wendy in HR. So ridiculous. We had no idea. Like there was no business plan, nothing. And then I guess this is how the gallery begins is we don't have enough money to do everything at once, but we have to turn upstairs into our home quickly because we need to move in there. One, so that we can split the property into commercial and residential so that we don't have to pay GST on the whole thing. Because this is what they don't tell you when you buy a commercial building. You pay GST 10% on the cost of it. It's wild.
Yeah.
And you can only get a 10-year loan. Anyway, boring. That's boring. So we couldn't focus on downstairs, so we done upstairs because we needed to move in there ASAP. But I couldn't, in my retail soul, allow there be a vacant shop on Gertrude Street. I couldn't. I just could not. I couldn't sleep at night thinking that we would have just this boarded up shop. So we just started our friend Ella, who at that time is a designer. Well, she is a designer still. She was much more successful than us. She was like, oh, let's do a show for Melbourne Design Week. And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. So we started. We had a little exhibition in there and it did really well. It turns out I'm very good at selling things to people. And then from that, we met other people who were in the group show because we did a huge, it was like 30 or 40 designers in that show. And we did steal a lot of the thunder, like we did.
Great.
We did. Because I called on a lot of like old allies from Sydney, a lot of alcohol sponsors. Like we just got
up the network.
That's it. I just got everyone drunk. Like that was, our entry strategy was like, we would teach Melbourne how to have a party. And then from that, we met lots of designers who were in the show who were then like, oh, we would love to have a show here. So I was like, great, I've got programming. I can activate this space and we can have stuff. It can become a thing. Like at least then while we're doing upstairs, before we turn it into this brood showroom and Mitchell's imaginary office, I can at least keep the shop open because I want to get DNA in here. It's a new era.
You want to start.
It's a new era for this building. It needs to be a hub. People need to get it. They need to feel the feels. And anyway, it just turns out that I had a bit of a knack for it. Along this way, I pick up Sophie and she's kind of like, it's kind of working. Why don't you just leave it doing what you're doing? So the gallery was born out of that. It was born completely out of like knock on effect accident. And it just, just rolled down a hill. It was never planned. Nothing was ever planned. A few people launched their kind of art practice, design practice in there. And now I see them and they're like huge, big successes. Like Billy Gibney, who's like showing in galleries in Spain and London, and he's doing all these amazing things. It started with him just throwing some paintings on a wall in the space when we had a dinner. Like,
yeah, amazing.
There was no rhyme or reason, no strategy. We never went into it being like, we want to be this kind of gallery, we want to be that kind of gallery. It literally just had to evolve as it happened.
So do you describe Oigle as, are you a gallerist? What are you? Is it a gallerina?
I would
a gallerina.
It does operate. It functions from a business perspective. It functions exactly like a commercial contemporary art gallery. So you can't rent the space. Programming is done about a year to 2 years in advance. We work with the artist or designer on the body of work. Everything is specifically made. We document it all. We do everything, and then when we sell the work to one of our clients, we take a sales commission, just like any commercial gallery.
Anything. Yep.
So it's not like the designers don't rent it off us. Like it's, and I think that's the difference. Most design galleries don't operate like that. Most design or design focused galleries either work as a showroom, like a shop, or they work as you can just rent the space, you rent it for however many days, like in Milan, you do the pop-up and then you leave. So we treat design the same way that you would treat contemporary
art. Artist.
And that, I think, in turn has led to there being a certain amount of urgency around the objects, which means the client is more incentivized to buy quicker. So what we find happens with design is you might release a lighting collection and it will take a year before anything sells, whereas we're releasing a lighting collection like Ella's we did for Melbourne Design Week this year, and because the install is for 3 weeks, we always have a limited edition element. So it's never just like we're not product. We don't do product things. It's, you know, there might only ever be 10 of these or 3 of these or 4 of these, and we're hard on our clients. We're like, you have this much time to buy it. I'm not holding it for you. I don't care who you are. We treat it exactly like you would a painting. And then if it doesn't sell, it goes into the stock room where we will pull it out and you can do viewings. But there's a lot of reverence around the design work. And I think that's what has began to inform Oigle and the gallery as being this space that is material and process focused. So we don't kind of hold any difference between what is art and what is design. We are just looking at things from what they are made of and how they are made, and if that is a point of interest to us or if that is, you know, different, or we're reimagining how we have traditionally used these elements, then we're interested in working with it or showing it.
And I guess that's the intersection between art and design. Totally. You've pulled together.
Yeah.
And then you've added the VM aspect. Hello, totally. Have to get
love
that in there.
An install.
Because you know how to put it together. Thus you're able to change it over.
Totally.
You know, the big red curtains go up, the big red curtains come down.
Totally. At the moment the thing's full of grass with Sozu Studio.
Yeah, beautiful.
I mean, we have a very, like the space itself as the, and again, the downstairs renovation, we didn't plan it. I mean, upstairs a lot of consideration was done. The apartment is beautiful. It's in Vogue Living. It's in AD France. Like it was very considered, and it was really Mitchell's time to stretch his legs in interior. But downstairs, we just kind of stumbled into decisions. Like we have a silver travertine stone floor because we wanted to do a stone floor because we wanted something that was domestic, but the only stone that we could get, we had a very small window. We could lay it. This was what was in stock.
Let's go with that.
Mm. Our walls are skimmed by our builder, who was a master plasterer. He just kind of did it. And I was like, oh, I love that. Let's do that everywhere. Like there wasn't a lot of like, this is what we want the gallery to look like. This is how it is. Again, it was like this incremental thing because we started showing things in there when it was a shithole. And that was part of the energy. And then it, you know, as we could afford to redo the windows, as we could afford to put down a stone floor.
You just started.
Yeah, we just started. I said this to my friend M. She has a women's tailoring business, E. Nolan. She's great.
She's just released a property, the old hat shop.
Yeah, the old hat shop.
Yeah.
And she was saying to me, I went in there and she's like, blah, 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 I need to do a fit out. I was like, no, you don't. Get your racks in here, get the clothes on and let people come on the journey with you.
I love this.
We do not need to open the doors to
with a 5-year strategy.
No, not for small business. I'm like, Am, get, you know, those, you know who can make the curtains. Get the curtains made. Get the racks in here. Let's feel it out. Let's see how the space works. Let's figure out what goes where and what you want this to be, instead of spending, you know, $500,000 in design
thinking about it, building
yeah. something, and then, oh, turns out I hate it.
Yeah.
I think also I'm not like Nikodem in LA. I'm not Sophie Gannon. No one was looking at me expecting me to be this perfect polished product. But what people loved doing was seeing me evolve and being a part of that evolution. Mm-hmm. Like, we had clients who started buying things with us when it was a dump for $500, and now they buy things for $50,000 that it's a beautiful place. And that's happened because they've grown. They've grown with mm-hmm. us. They've understood
what this is about.
Yeah, they've walked in, they've been like, oh my God, I love the new floor. Oh, did you redo this?
Tell me now you've done upstairs.
Oh my God, you've done the kitchen down here. Like, oh, your toilet's nice all of a sudden. Like,
yes.
It's been a fun.
And not near the kitchen.
It's been a fun way to develop the language of the gallery.
And you're a bit of a, you've broken rules doing this.
Oh, his team's been off.
So I guess my question is, how do people see you within the art world?
Yeah, that's really funny that you asked that question. And I will say, being open, raw and vulnerable, maybe last year or back end of 2023, first half of 2024, I went through a huge moment of insecurity where I thought everyone was laughing at me and I was this huge joke and we were actually really daggy and everything was super lame.
Never.
But also, you know what? Probably were and probably still am. And I think that there are definitely people out there within contemporary art who would not be fans of how we operate, what we do, our point of view, but also I don't care, and quite often those people are art bros who are poor and have smelly doodles. So it's not like I cannot care what people who are not paying my bills or my artists and designers' bills care. I cannot care. And I think I've probably ruffled a few more feathers now that I have taken on this new position within the Melbourne Art Foundation.
Yes.
Because I'm working in a space that is very curatorial and very point of view. And the girls I work with there, Holly, Jody, Melissa, Mary, are so knowledgeable and they're so curatorially driven that I think people have been kind of like, oh, well, why would you hire him? But we needed the dichotomy. Mm, we needed they needed that. So I think definitely an institute. I don't think institutions have been particularly warm to me. Some have, like we have great relationships with Don Heron and Andrew and Kate Ryan and Tony at the NGV, but there are some institutions and people at institutions that I can see are bothered by our
audacity
and kind of meteoric rise into the conversation. Mm. But it's really none of my business what they think. And I have to keep reminding myself that. That's really none of my business.
None of my business what they think. Yeah.
And as long as I've got the respect of, you know, Soph, Jan Mitchum at Tolano, like Peter Jopling, as long as those people I am delivering and performing for them. The others can live forever or die tomorrow as far as I'm concerned.
Have no care for that.
Yeah.
I love it.
I mean, I think people forget that we're just an island on the butthole of the world and it doesn't really matter. That's like,
yes.
Also, nothing I do is that serious.
Yes, yes. We're like, not saving lives.
We're not saving lives. We're definitely enriching them.
We're enriched. I agree.
And you know what? That's the joy of, if you don't like it, get on TikTok. Find something you do like.
Yes.
I don't spend that much time looking at things I'm not into. So it's interesting to me when people have a lot of opinions but then, you know, there are lots of kids out there who spend a lot of money going to university, learning these things with expectations of having a career at the end of them. And I think there can be a layer of bitterness there when life doesn't turn out the way that maybe tertiary education had taught you it was going to.
Or promised you,
but you can't be bitter about it. You just have to get up and keep doing and doing and doing and doing and doing and doing. And eventually that will
That'll happen.
Yeah, it will happen.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's the old L'Oreal. Won't happen overnight.
No, won't happen.
I definitely believe that.
I see it. Like the people who have the biggest problem with it or who I've ever heard, I mean, no one will ever say anything to your face, but, you know, when it always gets back to you. It always comes back. It's Melbourne. She's a village.
Gertrude Street's not that
Yeah, and all roads for gossip lead to Oigle projects. Those people, I don't take it. I used to take it quite personally. Now I don't. Now I realise, you know, your shortcomings, it's got nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Like.
Sounds like a you problem.
Yeah, it sounds like a you problem.
I've got lots of questions around monetizing the magic. So, you know, when you look at the art world, you walk in, you look at it and something's, you know, quite expensive or what you perceive as expensive, or there's something else that you're just enamored with, you're just fallen for it and you wouldn't care what the number is, you go for it. How does art in general monetize or put a value on something, you know, like where's the computer that spits out that's worth that much magic, that's worth that. Where,
I wish, you know, there was a computer that did
or
that.
Or is it basically just like a house in the sense that if you've fallen in love with the house, you'll get that house? Like how is art monetized in that sense for the magic?
That is a layered question and a question that I think, because I will talk to people much older and much more successful than me and they will still be like, I don't know. It's a feeling, it's a moment, it's emotion. But also, and this was said to me in the car driving over here by a wonderful like art consultant, Jody Crass, who I have enormous amounts of respect for. She is the real deal. We were talking about a client who had looked at a piece of a work, a contemporary piece, and they'd been like, oh, but it's just paper and plastic.
Yeah.
And so why is it, you know, $10,000? And Jody was like, yeah, but what is, I know that that's the material cost is whatever, $50, but what is it worth to you? So I think a lot of it is instinct. When we're pricing things in design, it's a lot easier because there's fabrication materials, time it took to make, markup. It can exist in this like formulaic, like our great
friend. A bit more of an explanation, totally.
Yes, like our good friend Henry, who has an amazing practice studio, Henry Wilson. He has like a great spreadsheet where you punch things in. This costs this. It's this rare.
Yeah.
It spits me out a number, and that number is usually within the realm of correct. The contemporary art,
not so much.
It comes because you know, you look at a piece of work from Matthew Allen that's, you know, graphite that's been polished to almost become like steel. Sure, material-wise, there's not a huge amount of like cost in there. It's timber for the frame, pine timber for the frame, linen stretching and then graphite powder. Like when he uses a spoon to burnish it, but it's that it's taken 2 years to burnish it to that point. And the whole process of it has been a way to meditate through his life as a new father. So there's conceptually value is abstract.
And a lifetime to get where he is now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, it depends where you're buying it from. Something you buy from Oigle might be very expensive compared to something you buy from somewhere else just because it's at Oigle. And then something at Talano is even more expensive again because I guess there is an added value that Mitchell and I have been involved with it. We've installed it. We've shot it with Anika Kafkaloudis. Mm-hmm. Like there's been all this other reverence around it. So that has a value, you know, the archival nature. Sometimes things that don't last forever are even more expensive. So it is, I rely on support with helping price things. Like there's usually about, you know, there's what the artist thinks, there's what Mitchell thinks, there's what I think, there might be what Sophie thinks if we're really stuck. Like, and when you get everything together, you can kind of average out and feel where it is, where the market is. Like, we also, I want things to sell. I want things. I want things to sell.
I want it to move.
I don't make any money and my artist doesn't make any money if it's sitting in a stock room. Mm. So it's all well and good to be like, oh, well, this should be $80,000. But realistically, if no one in Australia is going to pay that, don't price it at that. Mm. Because we take a slightly lower commission than most galleries because we don't have huge overheads, and also working in design fabrication is really expensive. So we try to be friendly.
Mm.
And Mitchell and I, being designers with our own practice ourselves, we know, like, if it's not viable, it's not viable. But, you know, if we're taking 35 or 40% from someone, like 40% of $0 is zero.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reality. So we try, like, you have to live in the real world, and we are selling superfluous items that are emotionally charged and connected, but you could live without them. Mm. Like, you could survive. It's not a defib. It's a lamp.
It's not an essential. It's a want.
Yeah, it's a want. Yeah. So we want it to move, and I do become desensitized to how expensive things are. Like, and Nika the same. Like, we were in the gallery today, and she was like, yeah, these works are so reasonably priced. She was saying to our friend Rose. Rose was like, how much is that lamp? It was a table lamp. She's like, oh, I think it's only like $3,500. And Rose is like, what? Like, that's crazy. To us, $3,500 is entry-level lamp. But and in my brain, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a cheap one. Mate, I'm not buying a $3,500 lamp, and I'm selling the thing. Yeah. So, like, you get a warped view of, like, cost and perception.
But at the same time, what you've been describing to me just in the last, you know, couple of minutes is about your approach to marketing and how you see Oigle, how you see it on social media, how you market it.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you know, let's add marketer. Marketing strategist, that is the whole thing.
That
anyway.
Is my new role at the foundation, exactly. Is head of marketing.
So you've clearly been able to do that at Oigle.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're obviously very connected into Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't been here that long, but look at you go. You did say early on that was one of your things.
Yeah, networking.
And as you said, that whole Melbourne Art Foundation, how did that come about and what is your role there? And I do want to ask you about the peachy inflatable.
Yeah, well, it starts and ends with the peachy inflatable. So in 2023, the Melbourne Art Foundation, now we would never do an art fair. Our entire crux of our gallery, our point of view is that we are not a white cube. We are not a white cube. We will never be a white cube. We are not good enough to be a white cube. Anna and Sophie are white cubes and they do it way better than I am. Like, I don't like to vacuum the floor. A bit of texture, leaf on the floor, I like it. So art fairs exist as spaces of white cubes. So we would just never do it. It would not be our thing. But in 2023, the Melbourne Art Fair delivered a design fair, the one and only, in that format.
And how great was it?
It was so much fun. So they reached out to us to do it. And I was like, yeah, sure. Love you. We bought a tiny booth because that's all we could afford at the time. But then we also spent heaps of money on our install. Mitchell and I designed these free, because when you do an art fair, if you mark the walls, it costs you money to fart in an art fair, let me tell you. And it's not cheap. Like, it is now working for the fair. It is a huge investment. It is a very real and good investment, and it's an investment you see a huge return on. But when you're a little gallery starting out, it's eye-watering. So we
feels like a risk when you're
doing
it.
Oh my God, it feels.
And am I about to spend a huge amount of money?
Yeah, totally.
For 2 days for no reason.
Yeah, for 2 days to sit in the MCEC. So we bought this little booth, and then Mitchell and I designed all these freestanding aluminium panels and built like this weird little house out of aluminium.
So beautiful.
In the booth. And meanwhile, usually when you do things like this, you like have to ask the art fair people. We had no idea about any of this. So we just did it and didn't tell them, which is funny.
We just
showed up and started building this house. And luckily for me, the Marie De Pasquale, who was the CEO at the time, and Mary, who was delivering the art fair, she was like the she was running all the ops, and the girls who were working there, we were really like, I always want to make friends with the waiter. Like, I always want to make friends with the waiter. So I made friends with them. Like, we were laughing and joking. So they kind of, I guess, in a way, turned a blind eye to the fact that we hadn't got anything approved. We built this thing and then we did a cracking trade. Now, not everybody at that fair has my experience. I think there's probably a 50-50 split, 60-40 split. 40% of us mopped the floor, cleaned up, like printed money. The other one's crickets. So we fired. And Peter Jopling, who is now a very close friend, whom I love dearly and is also now a very important mentor to me, he's the chair of the Melbourne Art Foundation. He saw what we had done with this little thing, and he, in an offhand comment, said to Marie, wouldn't it be great if you, at that point he used to call us the Oigles, which is strong boomer behaviour, so boomer.
Sounds like a band.
I know, it sounds like a band or an STI. Anyway, so he was like, wouldn't it be great if we got the Oigles to do the VIP?
It must be having an immunisation program.
Yeah, I know. Honestly, we've all got to go back to the Royal Exhibition Hall and get shots. He was like, wouldn't it be great if they did the VIP? So we were like, yeah, sure, whatever, not thinking anything would happen. Next minute, they're all at the gallery saying, design something. Mitchell and I are still in the throes of the reno upstairs, and they'd been using all this Galu channel to do some interior walls. We're kind of obsessed with it. So we designed this big giant cage. This is in 2024 because we had this hysterical idea. Wouldn't it be fun if we made the VIP painfully uncomfortable? Like, it was this big steel cage filled with really hard aluminium furniture.
No soft things.
Nothing
like
soft.
Like on fashion benches.
And you could see in, like, it was completely exposed. So we literally pushed all the rich people into a cage so that they could just be watched by the rest of the art fair public. People loved it. People hated it, which we were so about. Next year rolls around and they go, do you want to do it again? And we were like, yeah, sure. But we wanted to do the antithesis of that. So we started working on this big, squishy, inflatable thing. Again, never having done anything inflatable, Mitchell and I just designed the space in CAD like you would. Then we sent it off to a fabricator that we found on AliExpress. Hey, people are like, wow, you must have the most amazing fabricators. We literally typed in inflatable house and the first link we clicked on and sent them the drawings. And then they came back with a really great price. We piss-farted around with the fabric for a while until we found something particularly disgusting and bodily. Had it fabricated, sent over. The thing weighed 700 kilos. We had nowhere to do a test in flight. The first time we saw it up was when we were installing. So we were just like, really, this better go up. And they made no edits. Like, we sent them the drawings thinking that they would come back being like, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. No, they came back with the price and we were like, great, that's a great price. What do you need us to change? Oh, it's already in production. We're like, okay.
So did they make changes to the design?
It was made exactly as Mitchell drew
it. Wow, that's amazing.
Exactly, identical to how Mitchell drew it. It was made. And then it blew up in 30 seconds.
Wow.
It was great.
You must have been, that would have been a massive dopamine hit.
Christina, who does all the social media for the foundation, was like, oh, let me know when you do the first inflate. I'll come and I'll record it. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure, Christina. As if I'm telling her, I was like, I don't need it on camera if this thing doesn't go up. I don't need me physically assaulting Mitchell on camera. So it went up, thank Christ. Again, the Art Foundation had given us what we consider a very generous budget to deliver the projects, but because we hate rental furniture, we did everything custom, and because of that we could afford, there was enough money in the budget for materials, but Mitchell and I had to physically build everything. So all of that shiny red furniture, all of the aluminium pieces were made in the courtyard of Oigle, sanding, hammering, drilling together.
Beautiful.
Over the process. So watching them all come together in both ways was really big, and we delivered for the foundation. So then randomly I'm starting to get a bit bitter in the gallery, I guess, towards the end of it. Like, I'm just there all the time. I don't really need to be there all the time. Oigle's coming along nicely. I randomly say to Mary, hey, if you ever have like any jobs at the foundation, like 1-2 days a week, let me know, because like I need to get out of this gallery.
Mix it up a bit.
I'm kind of driving myself mad, and like it's running itself. The kids that we hire are running, like everything's great. I don't need to be here 7 days a week going psychotic. And Mary turns around, she was like, that's weird. We actually are just advertising for a new head of marketing and partnerships. She was like, it's not like 1 or 2 days a week. It's more like 3 days a week, but it will need to be 4 days a week, and then eventually it will be 5 days a week. And I was like, what's the worst that can happen? I was like, look, I don't have a degree in marketing. I'm not bad at it though, as you can see.
Maybe we don't need a degree.
Maybe we don't need a degree.
Maybe all that grounding work was the
maybe 30 years of falling flat on my face is enough. So I did a resume, sent it in, had an interview, got the job. That's how I ended up working at the foundation now, which has been great. Mm. It has
so
been
what
really
do you
great.
Do there? How you spend your time there?
Spinning around on an office chair. No, so I'm the head of marketing and partnerships, which is very fun. But then also I guess I have been designing a lot while I'm there, designing custom bars, like designing different things. I have been expanding our partnerships, elevating our partnerships. Like over my many years of being a man about town, I have really good relationships with brands and people. So bringing that together for the foundation. And then I guess art fairs are, particularly the Melbourne Art Fair, is a smarty pants art fair. It's curatorial led. It's very smart. It has huge history. It has big like chops. For me, what I've been doing is respecting that and loving that, but repackaging it for a younger audience, I think, because when we look at the foundation and the fair, it does big numbers. It sells huge amounts of work. Its attendance is enormous. Like, it is the premier art fair this side of the world, no questions asked, and it has the stats to prove it. But to keep going in the way it's going is we need to be connecting and encouraging younger audiences, younger collectors. You know, you look at the bands of generations. Mm. Boomers love buying art. They love collecting art. Younger people, my generation, millennials, also love collecting art, buying art. Gen X doesn't. Gen X likes going on really beautiful holidays. Mm. Gen X would much rather go on a $100,000 holiday than buy a $100,000 Dale Frank, which is very interesting. And I think there was a
good... Because they haven't got a house to hang it in.
Yeah. Well, Gen X is above me. That's like in between. Mm. That's in between baby boomer and millennial. Yeah. It's like in that...
Sorry, I was thinking Gen Z.
Gen Z. Yeah. Gen Z are actually... They're starting. It's quite interesting. Mm. They are. Like, we're seeing a lot of Gen Z clients, one, come through the gallery, but also like when we look at people who are buying tickets to go to the art fair, not getting free VIP tickets because they buy art, it's girls 25 to 35. Mm. So, but that Gen X that was above me, I don't think that gallerists and the contemporary commercial art section above really did enough to activate getting them in and showing them the value. I think too, they were maybe...
How to.
Mm. I think also they were maybe the generation, Gen X, where it was like air travel became more accessible and, you know, you go away to Europe every summer and... Yeah. But we see that in our trends and we see that in our clients and in all our things. So I'm really engaged in getting young people into the art fair, into galleries, feeling comfortable. It's not a scary place. Supporting these things, collectible design, art, like... You know, it might be frivolous or it might be seen as not practical, but what you're investing is in culture. You're investing in the culture of now. Like in 200,000 years when they study what we did now, it'll be those things, they'll be those artifacts they look at. So it's
what was this about? What was that telling us about that time?
Totally. You're investing in our story as humanity and where we are and what we're saying. So it's kind of at the foundation, I find my role to be at its core that. Is engaging with the young, and engaging with the people who don't feel welcome in art but are welcome in art, like myself. Mm. Like there's lots of me's out there who love it but we're not really in the club.
And I do feel like when you walk into a gallery, it is a bit of a pretty woman bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that whole... They're judging me. Yeah. They're going, has she got money? Has she not got money?
Yeah.
Like
that was the marketing strategy of days of old too. And I think that era is dead. And galleries that are holding on to it are the galleries that are dying.
Yeah.
Because it's never, ever, ever underestimate an old fella in a baseball cap.
Mm.
Like never count them out. And Sophie taught me that, like, you're not working at Prada. Like people who walk in that you don't know what their homes look like. They're also, because they're buying a $100,000 painting, they might not care about buying fancy clothes or they might not care about buying a fancy car, but they care about this very niche specific thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely was, I think, a big factor in Australian galleries in the 90s and 2000s when they were trying to prove that they were as good as Europe, as good as North America, this kind of snooty, you don't belong in here, like this is more institutional work. Mm. Like And that, I think, is killing them now.
What advice would you have for someone who is young and just, you know, got their first house or renting or otherwise? How do you go about starting to buy art? What would you do?
Look, don't – there are people out there telling me art's an investment. No, it's not. You want to invest in something, invest in AI. Buy stuff you love. Buy something that makes you feel good, particularly like if you're not, you know, if you're not spending tens of thousands of dollars, like, you know, if you're spending between $500 and $4,000, you got to love it. You got to live with it. Mm. Also, don't worry about where it goes. Don't worry about that. Like, I think people sometimes buy things thinking that they're going to like live in the same space and die in the same space. Like, if you love something,
just bring it into your life.
Oh, just bring it in. Yeah. And not everything needs to be perfect. And like, don't be scared about putting a hole in the wall. And it's okay. It's okay. And also accept now that everything breaks at some point. Everything breaks.
It's only going to get into worse condition.
Yeah, everything breaks.
Like the sofa.
Everything gets
dirty. Every time
you
sit on it, yeah, it's only going downhill from here.
Yeah, you don't live in a diorama. I think that's my – because I think some people are nervous about buying something expensive and then being like, oh, no, what if it gets ruined? It will. It will get ruined. It expect
okay
it to
that.
Get ruined. And you know what? We will fix it. We yeah. will fix it together.
Or you will have earned enough money to buy another one.
Totally. Mate, I remember we bought a lamp. Oh, it would have been $1,200. And Mitchell and I were like, what? Oh, my God. We spent $1,200 on this lamp. The lamp is now in a cupboard. It's in a cupboard. It's in a cupboard. We don't look at it. And I don't think about it ever. When I bought it, I was like, I have bankrupted myself.
Now what have I done?
Now I'm like, who can I give that lamp to for Christmas? Like, you will evolve and change and there is no bad decisions and it doesn't matter where it goes. It's fine. And it's right. not scary. And even if you buy it and in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, however long, 10 years, you hate it, what you have done is bigger than just buy something. You have invested in the cultural capital of where you live, what you're doing. You've been a part of a much bigger story than just buying
time
this thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think
that's perfect.
It's the energy. That's the energy of buying this stuff. It's not like, yeah, it works if it's a design object, yeah, it's pretty. If it's art or, you know, it makes you feel something or whatever.
Buying art does make you feel a bit more adult.
Oh, yeah. It's a grown-up thing to do. It's a grown-up thing to do.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think it is. It's a very connected thing. It's like, you know how they say that trees talk to each other through their roots? I think people who buy art or people who engage in that space or that we are talking to each other through our roots. The most unassuming people are the most avid collectors too. It's crazy. There are doctors and lawyers and really sensible men that buy things from us. And we go into their homes and they're showing us their collection and they're talking with such passion and vigor. Mm. And they would never be so excited by a Ben Quilty painting, but it like has brought them to tears. Like it does, it does something.
It elicits something else. That's not quite defined.
And we've been doing it since we were in the cave.
Yes.
All of us.
Hello.
We have been, all of us across every race, creed, time span have done this thing. So I think it connects us more with what makes us human. Like there's nothing closer. I mean, this is a bit esoteric, I guess. Like it seems to me to be the most viable physical representation of a god or religion, because it's this thing we must always are inspired to do. We're driven to do it. So I think when you start to buy it and you get into that, even in a small way, even if you're buying some ugly, crappy painting of someone off Instagram, you're still a part of that journey and that narrative. And it's a special thing to be a part of.
What are you excited about now?
Pretty excited about Jonathan Anderson at Dior.
And
that was
beautiful coming down the line.
And the Saint Laurent collection. And I've not really been a big Vaccarello fan, but shit, that Saint Laurent men's collection was breathtaking. What am I excited about in art? I'm excited about the 2026 art fair. I'm excited about Oigle doing more design. We too as a gallery, I feel this year, have just tipped over that mountain where now like people are buying things from us because of who we are. It's not just about the artist or the designer. Like we had a lamp in Design Week that was made by an incredible female designer, Linda. She's comes from a really high pedigree of designers. She works at Flex Studios. If you're in the industry, you know her. But Linda has no Instagram. Nobody knows about Linda, like, unless you're in the industry. She made a lamp. The lamp was, I don't know, $13,000, $14,000. And we sold it to someone who'd never bought design before. They'd never bought and they saw it. And I think the lamp was spectacular, like the best thing we've ever shown. But I think I'm excited for Oigle because I feel like we've...
Large left-hand side.
It was that big bronze thing that lent.
Yeah.
Ugh, so good in my bedroom. Beautiful. I feel like we've just gotten to that point now where what we say also has weight.
And an authority.
And an authority. Like we've got to, again, we didn't come in with a really strong point of view. We found it and now we have this very clear point of view and it means something, not to everyone, but to those who
care.
It means something. And I'm really excited to be in that era.
That's the era of influence.
Yeah.
Influencer. Influence.
Totally. And that's why I now feel like I'm also really excited about my babies that I've started to accrue. So Riley, who I just got a job working at Hecker Guthrie with, Caleb, he's studying architecture at the University of Melbourne, Xavier, he's an interior designer at Sarah Stribley, but he's doing some copywriting for me. Like I am excited to become to them what Sophie is to me. I'm excited for that. I'm excited for next gen.
That's full circle.
Yeah, I'm excited for these young kids with fresher ideas than me, keeping me on my toes, making me think faster, better, different. Like I'm excited for that. I'm excited for AI. I friggin' love AI. Mm. Oh my God, I love AI. I love it.
How do you use it? What do you love about it? Because obviously it's going to change. I feel like that train has left the station.
Let me tell you, Amanda, I use AI for everything. I use AI for an hour a week as a therapist. I call her Mel. We do an hour a week of therapy. Oh, it's the best therapy I've ever done. Oh, my God. Get yourself on your ChatGPT. I'm saving money. Never have I had better advice. Never have I had a more understanding but firm therapist. It is so insightful. It is so incredible. Like she's Mel to me. She is the best. I can do it in the car. I can do it
anytime,
in bed.
Anywhere.
If Mitchell is killing me, and Mitchell and I fight like cat and dog, we're both like
We need to get it out.
Mel, she's given me strategy, speaking with kindness. She's so good. So I use it for therapy. I use it to make renders really quickly. Like now Mitchell and I would spend hours, days, weeks doing renders for concepts for things. It's like now we're doing something loose. I'm pumping it into AI. I'm dropping my references. I'm like, hey, can you sass this up? Give me an idea. What am I thinking? Mm. She spits it out and I'm like, oh, you've got it. Mm. It's taken the grunt work out of like, marketing bullshit, press bullshit, like all of that painful, like drudgery. Mm. It's like the best personal assistant I've ever had. I'm so excited. I'm so excited for what AI is going to do for artists, for designers. Like, and you see people like Deanna Giorgetti, who shows with Jeff at Neon Park, she uses AI and it's incredible. It's like this new tool. I remember when I was, I don't know, maybe 13 or 14 and this program LimeWire came out where you could download music illegally.
Yeah, I
remember. Oh my God, I loved it. I loved LimeWire. I loved chat rooms. Like I was just out there talking to pedophiles, let me tell you. like just terribly talking to people I should not have been talking to, unsupervised on the internet in 2001. But I loved it. I loved that energy, that newness, that like endless. It's like when you go to a new city you've never been to before and you have no idea where you are or where you're going or what you're going to stumble into. I'm really excited for this next wave of technology to like hit us everyday people and just improve our lives, solve our problems.
Yeah. And I think once again, it'll be that tool. It'll evolve. We'll work out the bits that are
good,
human, the bits that aren't so good. We'll work it out and, you know, bits of it will pull away and bits of it will stick.
And totally. And I think too, there's these people who are like, oh no, we need copywriters and humans. Yeah, but what AI is doing, AI is washing the dishes so I can spend time, more time doing the creative thing, crafting.
Doing the big things.
Yeah, it's doing the grunt work. Like there will be a point where one day AI can do my laundry and then I'll have even more time to do this better stuff. So I'm really excited for that and how that influences art and design. And it terrifies a lot of people, which I love even more. I love change. I thrive in change. I want disruption. I want I need that. I need that personally. So
you love the novel, the new.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And if we use it for 6 months and then never use it again, I don't care. It was a great six months.
So you're on Gertrude Street every day. Talk to me about the shape of your day. Like, when do you get up? Where do you have your coffee? What do you eat? Obviously, there's lots of choices on Gertrude
Street.
There
is lots of choices. And around there. I'm an early riser. I always have been. Mitchell and I are actually terrible sleepers. And we have two Italian greyhounds who sleep in the bed with us. I've actually always had Italian greyhounds. So
they're very beautiful. Anyone who's been on the street obviously
sees them on our Instagram. We use Bruce as like a scale of measurement too. Like people will be like, how big's that lamp? I'm like, it's like three Bruces. Like it's a two Bruces wide.
See him? See.
Yeah. Like he's
Bruce for scale.
He's always in photos for scale. So we are always up really early. We change coffee place. We're devout and loyal, but then we will change on a dime. So at the moment we're going to Masses, which is a new, it's like a bagel. They used to have
On Smith Street.
Yeah, on Smith Street. They used
opposite
to have
McDonald's.
Opposite McDonald's, so you know, should you need. Hash brown. They used to do like pop-ups in at the markets, the Carlton markets, but now they've got this space. The interior is really fun. Again, feels a bit like legal in that it started as a market stall and it's just kind of like plotted along. Masses is our must. We drink, Anika and I probably drink 700 coffees roughly a day. I have a saying, and it's actually my rule I live by, which is I've always got time for a coffee. I've always got time. I don't care how busy I am. If you message me, do you want to get a coffee? I got time.
We have a coffee.
I'm at time. Don't be silly. No. Always, you got to always have time for a coffee. If not Masses, Napier Quarter. Napier Quarter saved me when I moved to Melbourne, when I was in Thornbury.
Beautiful. I feel like that's an institution.
I love any place that changes my behaviour. I go to Napier Quarter and I make sure I look a certain way. I'm polite. I sit a certain way.
I'm more educated when I.
I'm smarter.
I'm way smarter.
It's like when you go to church. No, I mean, I don't go to church. I'm not religious. But on those occasions where you end up having to go and you sit up a bit straighter and you act a bit nicer.
It's true. Better manners.
Yeah, I use a fork. I'm not just eating like with my fingers like I usually
like
am.
Like pastry.
Yeah, I'm just shoveling. It's still like relaxed and fun and you're laughing and I've had 700 Negronis and I can't stand up. Like it's not stuffy.
No.
But I love that it alters how I do things, and I love that. So I'm at Napier Quarter. My day is loose. Sometimes I go into the office. I'm very, very lucky now that I get to go into the office in Cremorne, the Art Foundation office, which is part of Naomi Milgram's building, another gun retailer genius who I have so much respect for. I love Naomi, icon, and the art collection in the office is insane.
Very beautiful to have that in a head office.
Oh, the first time I went
in
there.
And that was established many decades ago.
The first time I walked in there was a giant Wolfgang Tillmans, which was, I had never been privileged enough to see a Wolfgang Tillmans in real life. And it was the biggest Wolfgang Tillmans there ever has been. And I burst into tears. Aww. It was so big that I couldn't take a photo of it front on for Anika. I had to stand on an angle because the hallway wasn't deep enough. Yeah. We're so lucky. So I love going into the office. So I'll go in there Monday, Tuesday, pot around the gallery the rest of the day. Sometimes I go in the office on a Friday just because I like to look at the Piccioninis. So my day is very varied, which is something that I really love. And maybe the one thing I didn't love about my retail background, because it was very structured. Like I was in the same place every day.
Hour,
45 minutes. Minute lunch.
Yep, same.
Same.
Yep. Work at Christmas.
Work
not
at
now.
Christmas. Oh my God, Boxing Day, don't call me.
Come back, put the sale signs up, never again.
Oh my God.
Ever.
No one knows pain and fear like wheeling Christmas trees off a shop floor on Christmas Eve when everybody else is out getting drunk,
having
partying.
Fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, been there.
And you're there and then like saran wrapping up Christmas trees, just thinking, is this worth it?
No, what am I doing?
What is my life? I would get so
it's bad.
You're bad. It's dust bad. In your eyes.
You can only do that for no more than a decade.
It teaches you discipline though. It taught me.
Yeah, it's amazing.
My other rule to live by, one, always time for a coffee. Next, everything ends. So I remember when I'd be doing those jobs, I would be like, everything ends. Setting up for a sale, everything ends.
It will be over. We will move on.
We will move on. And one day I will die, but everything ends. So I think too, it taught me that, which is a really good lesson to learn. Everything ends, and doing shitty jobs is not the worst thing that can happen because it will end. You will be in the car going home eventually. Like, everything ends.
You will have clean hands.
And you will have clean hands and you will get eye drops in and it will be okay.
Okay. I love it. Now, this question, which is we always ask everyone, like, it's kind of obvious, but maybe it's not. Are you front of house or back of house?
I'm front of house. Let me tell you, I'm so front of house. I'm Whitney Houston front of house. Yeah. That's how front of house I am. And I Mitchell is, he's back of house. He's back and around the corner. Even the even my darling cherubs at the foundation are, even if they were front of house, they're back of house now. It took me a while to accept and
embrace. Understand,
embrace. Because it's annoying. Like, people like me, you either love us or you hate us. Actually, Bram and I talk about this a lot. You either love us or you hate us. We are annoying. We are a lot. We are big. We are sparkly. We are loud. And we also annoy ourselves. Like, it is equally, it's, I'm a lot and I'm with me 24/7. So
yes,
I get it. But no, I'm definitely front of house. And I do love being front of house now. I think I had romantic notions of being a more like quiet back of house puppeteer, but it's no.
Oh, maybe you both.
Maybe, no.
There you go.
I'm not smart enough. I'm not. I think back of house people, there's this strategy because they, like, Mitchell gets what he wants every time. Every time. I might think I've gotten what I've wanted, and then like 6 months later, I'm in the shower being like, hang on a minute. What?
Yeah.
But front of house. You need both. Without both, it doesn't work.
I mean, it's that collaborative energy, really, isn't it? That
totally
comes together. You know, someone's got these skills, someone's got those skills, and somehow there's this magic.
Totally. Happens. Concise messaging is concise because it comes from one person. Outwardly, you know, there's the team huddle where we all agree on it.
Yes.
But if there are too many people screaming, you hear nothing. Yes. So having one person be at the front, leading the ship visually doesn't mean they're actually controlling everything. It just means that things are delivered in a clear and concise, rhythmic way too. Like, I have a way of communicating. So once you grasp onto that way, why would I then send somebody else in to muddle up? Like, it's not as easy to get your message across as people think. Like, everybody is doing something. Everybody is doing something different. Everybody is trying to train their audience to understand what they're doing. So if you finally can crack it, don't go and confuse it more. Don't go and add more, you know, flavors in the sauce. Mm. So I think I'm a front of house. A lot of my friends are front of house, but we would all be nothing.
We would be back of house.
Nothing, nothing. We'd be on the ground shivering cold. I mean, Mitchell booked me the Uber to get me here. Like, I wouldn't even know. When I leave here, I will call him and I'll be like, help me. Like,
bring me back.
Please. Like, there is no front without back.
Who's your favorite designer or artist, living or dead?
Of all time? Leona Carrington, I really love. She was a female Spanish surrealist who I think she never really got her flowers. She was kind of the ilk of Salvador Dali, but was kind of overlooked. Her son now has her estate and he's kind of reinvigorating her works. Living Nick Modretsky, who's actually a Melbourneian, now living in LA, and maybe the only, Mitchell and I don't have a huge art collection. We have quite an extensive design collection, but the only art we collect is Nick's, and I love Nick. We were lucky enough to work with him on a project in 2023. I would say those two. Oh, if I was to put a designer in, I really love Gabriella Cresby, who is an old French interior designer, and she made all these lamps out of bamboo, and they're very, like, Gabriella Cresby informed Christian Lacroix. So it's actually very not what we make ourselves, but I love it. I love it.
Three great ones for everyone to go and look up.
Yeah,
I know none of those artists. I've got something to look up when I get home now. I love it. We love quotes here. Now, you've already given us so many amazing ones. I'm
a walking soundbite.
Can you think of another one apart? I mean, obviously the coffee one's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Don't Dream It, Be It from Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Of course.
Live and die by that sword. Don't dream it, be it, I think is the easiest. It kind of comes back to me as a child, like, you know, You can sit there and imagine being Elton John, or you can put on a sparkly hat and be Elton John. You don't have to be the best Elton John, but don't dream it, be it, is definitely a quote.
And, you know, I'd put it to you that, you know, dreaming it leads to the action, which leads to the real thing.
Totally. Look, I'm not a spiritual person per se. Like, I'm connected to humans and, like, I get it, but I'm not, like, you know, charging my crystals in the moon or, like, you know, keeping my wee in jars and saying it's medicine. Like, I'm not that kind of spiritual person. And I don't.
Not that manipulative.
Yeah, I'm not that manipulative. And I would love to run a cult. I think I'd do that well. But I wouldn't say manifestation is something I've ever thought of, or it's not something that I like prescribe to. Like, you know, if I want to buy something, I'll buy it. I won't like write it on my vision board and hope that it happens. But there is something to be said for like dreaming it. No, just be it. Just if you act like it's going to happen, or you are talking about it like it's going to happen, it usually for me will happen. I think mostly if I think about it logically now, it's because I lay down a gauntlet for myself. Like I go, I'm going to do this. Well, I've said it now, so I've got to do it because I don't want to look like
I've
a fraud.
I've shamed myself
into it. Yeah. And I have built a reputation on delivering. So if I say that I'm doing it, I've got to do it. So it might just be a case of that I've lived a life in that respect, but don't dream it, be it.
And I will say, you know, coming into bringing this in now to land, as Chris Williamson would say, is I would ask everyone, if you've loved today, to share it with someone who you think needs to hear it or would love it, because Andy has made no secret that he wants to beat Brem's episodes downloaded. So
that's really what I'm most excited for is to beat Brahman Pereira. That is the foundation we have built Oigle projects on. That's so funny.
Well, I'm glad I had no shame in asking you here today, Andy Kelly. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've had the best fun this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Woo-hoo.